Hello. Morning. I welcome you on the second day of the deactivism conference. Today we are trying to get serious in a sense that we're gonna see and look into how very concrete illegal economic and political frameworks have been constructed and reconstructed through various activist practices. And it is my honor to introduce Juhai Vänter. He doesn't need an introduction, I guess, but to welcome him in Budapest and ask him to deliver his keynote on his new book that's going to be out early next year, I guess.
Yep.
And you said this is the first time you lecture on this book.
Yeah.
We are honored. Yes, Professor Vänter.
Well, it's a great, great honor and pleasure to be here and to be in Budapest and to speak to you. And this book that will be coming out in March is The Wealth of Networks, How Social Production Transforms Markets and Freedom. And I thought this would be an appropriate place to start talking more explicitly about politics and about freedom. And I hope you'll be patient with me as we go through this, and starting late will also probably end a little later. So let's start with this.
Do you need light?
Who knows the sound?
Too much light here, you can't see it. That's it. If that's not enough, let's just put this in place. The blue, if you noticed at the end of the lettering, is the blue of IBM. And this is produced by an employee, with or without authority, it's unclear, but clearly without copyright clearance, because you can't find it anywhere now. In Bangalore, presented at the Bangalore Linux Users Group about 4 or 5 years ago. And the question essentially for us for today is, what on earth could justify thinking in terms of this continuity, using and mixing all of these Hollywood representations of revolution with an operating system? And so let's start with a fact. Between 1835 and 1850, The cost of starting a what was considered at each of these times a mass circulation day in the United States went up from being roughly the equivalent of $10,500 to be in today's terms to being the equivalent of $2.5 million. This is the point at which it stops being something that one does for all sorts of reasons and starts being something that one needs a business model. And the business model could be a market business model, as it was in the United States. It could be a state funding model. It can be a traditional nonprofit model. But the range of possibilities of how one starts a newspaper changes when the costs shift from $10,000 to start up to $2.5 million in today's terms. What we saw over the course of 150 years since that second quarter of the 19th century is that the high costs of technology and around the technology, the organizational adaptations of the emergence of professionalism created a stark bifurcation between consumers and producers, passive large audiences, professional commercial producers that were either market-based or government-based, the two modes that could raise the capital necessary to get the things with which you needed to capture, render, and communicate your ideas. And this characterizes and anchors the basic structure of information, knowledge, and cultural production in the public sphere throughout the last 150 years. Not everywhere, not in all modes, there's always sources of resistance. But the main of the public sphere in societies that have grown to a size that requires remote communication to get all of the relevant people connected, it then gets replicated in terms of its cost in radio, for a variety of reasons, not necessarily to do with technology as much as with regulatory adaptation, as well as technology in television, satellite, etc. What we're seeing, a critical enabling break in the network information economy, is a radical decentralization of capitalization. Not necessarily a total decline in capitalization, but the fact that each of these is a portion of the network, so that the physical capital means necessary to sense the cultural environment, to process it, to store it, to render your own utterance and to communicate it, is in the hands of everyone who either owns or otherwise has reasonably decent access to a computer. Which means that every connected person, and in today's terms that's somewhere between, depending on whose numbers you believe, 600 million to a billion people in the planet, has the physical capital necessary to make and communicate information, knowledge, and culture. So the image, which alas is no longer true because IBM Gene Blue has something around here, these are the formal supercomputers in the world in terms of their speed, and this is SETI at home. 4.5 million users sharing their leftover computer cycles when they don't need them to process images from NASA's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence radio astronomy project. This is in Terraform floating point operations. So this is just as an image to capture the amount of capacity, of sheer physical capacity distributed around the network today in the hands of people. And the second point is, people are quirkier than economic models suggest. But even within economics, human creative labor is widely understood to be highly variable across human beings, but not only across human beings, within every individual over time, both in short time frames, how I am now as opposed to how I will be at 10 o'clock at night, or in a week, or on the weekend, or at the end of the month, or in the summer, but also over longer time cycles, earlier and later, and a long life. It's also very personal, specific, and non-fungible. If any one of you has ever transferred a job you had, or a position you had to someone else, and tried to, in some sense, summarize for them everything you've learned in that job, you know perfectly well that it is impossible. So there's something very intrinsically available to human beings about their own creativity and experience and wisdom, and non-transferable. So we have this odd situation where the most important inputs to the core economic activities of the most advanced economies are widely distributed in the population. And this is really new. Both communication and computation resources and human creativity, intuition, experience, and motivation are radically distributed and not necessarily more effectively or efficiently centralized by anyone. What this does as a critical change factor is that it enables social relations, things we once understood as outside the economy, to play a vastly greater role in economic production. It creates a new solution space to a whole set of production problems that wasn't there, not because the motivation wasn't there, not because the structures of social relations and mutual giving and support weren't there, but because when you wanted to create a mass media communication, or if you wanted to create an automobile, it wasn't enough to want to do so and get with your friends on Saturday. Now it is. So let's separate between two connected but analytically distinct concepts, commons-based production and peer production. Commons-based production is production that is based on utilizing inputs from a resource set over which no one exercises exclusive rights. Right? It doesn't mean there are no constraints on how it's used. There might be constraints or there might not. But no one, unlike, and in this regard it's the polar opposite of property, no one exercises exclusive rights. It also involves appropriating the outputs, whatever it is that you've produced, appropriating its value to you without asserting exclusive control over it or exclusive proprietary rights. And it can be either individual or collective cooperative, and can be commercial or non-commercial. The critical point is how the inputs and the outputs are managed in terms of exclusivity versus non-exclusivity of control. So the classic sociology of science question somewhat today is looks like this. But even commercial things like trucking, which uses the commons of the road, as opposed to railroads, which use own infrastructure, is a business model that builds on a commons. And at the simplest level, inviting your friends to a party in the park, as opposed to inviting them to your apartment, or if you're so lucky as to have one, your backyard, those are ways in which one uses a private resource in order to achieve a certain outcome, as opposed to a public resource, or a commons-based resource. Peer production relates to various sized collections of individuals, can be very large, can be much smaller, that effectively produce an information good, and the efficacy here is critical to understand why it's important. And the definition is in a sense negative without price signals or commands. So if you actually, instead of talking about markets as everything that's decentralized coordination, you understand it as that which the coordination function is price, you have neither command hierarchy nor price. And we also are seeing, but I won't talk much about this, sharing of material resources like city at home, large scale practices of effective productive sharing of material resources, the components of capacity of material resources, including private economic goods. So distributed computing is like this. Open wireless networks. Wireless mesh networks that begin to actually develop not on an infrastructure basis with a point of access, but with sharing, which are in a technologically there, but as practices that hasn't quite been the direction that they've gone, are like that. Peer-to-peer networks are like that, right? Peer-to-peer networks is a distributed data storage and retrieval system. Put away the music aspect and the whole battles over the legality, and you just look at it, and you think in 1999 someone would have said, build me a globally available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, distributed data storage system that would be robust to attack. You could close down the central indexing service. You could inject corrupt files. You could send armed soldiers to shut down various servers and nodes, and nonetheless it would work. People would say it would cost millions of dollars and years to build, and yet that's exactly what peer-to-peer music is, isn't it? So just a couple of words. Free software, this is always, for the skeptics, this is always helpful. Right, 1995, two groups of people decide that server-side software is really important. And they build a server-side software once they understand there's going to be a lot of users on the web. One of them, after 10 years, captured 70% of the market, the other 20%. If you heard that the 20% is a bunch of volunteers and the 70% is Microsoft, you would say, wow, they succeeded in keeping 20%. But of course, the answer is this is Apache. These are the volunteers. This is Microsoft in one of its most strategic investments. And this is not a question of cost, because those that are up here include Amazon, which is not cutting its licensing costs for this purpose. It's just better for what they need. Wikipedia, we'll see Jimbo Wales later today, massively successful online encyclopedia. The Open Directory Project, which has more or less displaced Yahoo as the primary human edited directory of the web, 60,000 volunteers. So if we look together at the network information economy, what do we see? Human beings are diversely motivated. Human beings are diversely knowledgeable and creative. Information, knowledge, and culture now can be and are produced by more people for more diverse reasons in more diverse contexts outside of firms and markets without need to access capital or formal organization. Often when I speak about this little thing here, but I won't do it here. Just this creates new challenges for some market actors, like Hollywood and the recording industry. It creates enormous opportunities for other market actors, like IBM and Red Hat. And understanding these and being able to form alliances, and this is the only point I'll say about this here, being able to form alliances with and around those market actors who do see the benefit to them of supporting through platforms and tools and utilities and incorporating the outputs of the network information economy into their own supply chain. Together with those who are interested politically in the freedom and justice aspects that commons-based and peer production can produce will be a formidable alliance if it is formed and held, and if both sides understand the limitations and the benefits of this alliance. Because, and the reason for the alliance is because what I'll say at the very end, we are in the middle of a battle over the institutional ecology of the network information environment. Laws affect the ease or difficulty with which different social practices can be carried out. And Hollywood and the recording industry and in other areas of the pharmaceutical industry are pushing very effectively, both national, regional, and international levels, to create an institutional ecology that will make retaining the industrial information structure of production more efficient and effective and stable, rather only effective and stable. Efficiency has nothing to do with it. But they are doing so in ways that make it harder, not to say in the long run impossible, for the network information economy to emerge, for commons-based peer production to flourish. And so there's a battle. And in this battle, alliances will have to be made. So let's talk about freedom and justice. This is all derived out of the fact that the object of production in the network information economy is information, knowledge, and culture, which goes to what we know about the state of the world as it is, how we know it, how we define truth and authority, what we know about how the world may be and become, how we evaluate alternative courses of action and forms of relationship, the critical question of who gets to say what to whom, and who decides these questions. These all go to various aspects of freedom, depending on whether you're in freedom and development or development as justice, this could be understood as justice independently, how we manage the inputs and outputs of the information economy on a global scale directly affects human development everywhere. And in that regard, is a central question for justice. So I'll talk about autonomy, I'll talk about the networked public sphere, both purely in the political sense and in the question of critical culture, and I'll talk about access to information, knowledge, and culture, and to information embedded goods and tools as a dimension of human development. I won't say much about autonomy, but critically, if you take a substantive view of autonomy, people can do more for and by themselves, and people can do more in loose association with others. The looseness here is actually quite critical, because if you conceive of individuals as free within a context, and you understand the context to be both enabling and constraining, to have both affordances and constraints for human action, then what is new and interesting, particularly about network relationships, is not that they allow new and extended social relations, which is turns out to be empirically true, but that they also allow for new, looser associations when people can just, instead of having their whole life with a workplace, their whole life with a family or a community that is neighborly, that is stable, and that gives them the security of context. In addition to those, they can now have much more context-specific relationships that are enabled, like the peer production communities, like Wikipedia, like the free software, etc. So this underscores the move from consumers to users, from people who take from a given menu to people who use tools to create their own. Blogs are one example. An example we'll see later in the context of culture. Is the culture of anime video audio remixes, the ability to actually not just sit there in front of a screen but actually use and make your own is actually central to autonomy. Also the notion of moving from employees to peers, to have one domain. 15 years ago there was a very strong set of literature around the question of the organization of the workplace as a dimension of freedom, an idea of a third way. Roberto Mangabeira Unger wrote quite a bit about this. What we're seeing here is not the entire range of life, but a sector beginning to develop productive relationships where people are not order followers, but are actually conceivers of their own potential outputs. Obviously with free software, see it with Wikipedia. We're beginning to see firms, companies, experiment with peer production models internally. These are no longer commons-based peer production models, these are internal to the firm, but nonetheless beginning to understand. So Xerox suddenly understands that its technicians have enormous source of information about machines as they live through their life. And instead of treating them as order followers, here's the manual the engineers create, technician take out and implement, they create a database for peer-reviewed commentary and learning among the technicians about what they see in the field. That's the beginning of a shift within firms. That is perhaps optimistic to see broader, but we see a lot more interest in that today. If one takes a more prescriptive view of autonomy, a thinner view of autonomy that most philosophers of autonomy prefer, at a minimum, we can say that the extent of opportunities that this system creates to control the information environment of others is limited. So we have all sorts of non-proprietary workarounds around platforms and their control and the extent to which one can use them to manipulate what it is that the vast majority of people need to use in order to look on the world. You can keep the eyes on your prize as opposed to that of the provider. And the sheer diversity of critical insights about how life can be or can't be, is also a critical enabler of autonomy, even within the thin formal conception of autonomy. But as I said, the critical points are actually these. It's the actual capacity to practice autonomy both alone and in loose association with others. Let me talk about the political aspects of the public sphere. If one were to try to define in almost a formal sense what one who designs a public sphere, that is a technically mediated public sphere, would want, you'd want some form of universal intake. Because if in principle you live in a society where everyone's concerns are at least in principle appropriate for public action, then there must be some way of registering each person's concern, or at least observing it, and potentially filtering it into the public sphere. Then you need some form of filtering for political relevance of what it is that people want, and credibility as a political move. So political relevance would be a battle that we saw within feminism over the, or rather waged in the form of feminism, of my husband is beating me, not being politically relevant, and a shift to making it politically relevant. This is a critical question. But also continuing to retain my father won't give me sweets as being not politically relevant, even though in principle observable. And political credibility, right? The president takes money from oil companies is politically relevant and credible. The president is listening to aliens is equally relevant but not credible. We've done that in mass media through combining a whole lot of things. Now they're beginning to be disaggregated. Synthesis and salience, you have to turn statements that have been filtered in these ways out of the universal intake into something that is synthesized into a position that is sufficiently salient in society to be appropriate for political action or to be a statement within the broader social negotiation of the public agenda, and it has to be independent from government. So when you look at all of these, mass media obviously have some limitations. Tiny intake funds. Of necessity, at least elitist, if not biased in one form or another. Even if you have a very good mass medium, it is at least elitist because of the professionalism. And usually it actually suffers, there's huge literature on this, so I won't pretend to lecture, but one could collapse a lot into two basic effects, the Berlusconi effect and the Baywatch effect. The Berlusconi effect needs no explanation. Power of the media, either to use for their own interests or to sell. And when you're not busy taking over the public sphere in your own interest or that of your clients, make sure you don't offend too many people by not producing anything. So how does the network public sphere respond? And this is actually critical. Whenever you do these analyses, the question is not how is the public sphere relative to an ideal utopia in the network public sphere. It's always how is it relative to what we've had for the last 150 years, which is to say what we've lived with throughout the emergence of democracy from its battles, first with monarchy and then with fascism and state communism. Right? How is this different and better, if it is? And so, for example, in the United States, you could not see in any mass media outlet coffins because the Department of Defense was controlling very tightly the images until one person sent in a Freedom of Information Act request and just waited for months while he was doing his other stuff and got these images. The next day they were all over all of the press. But it took one person who wasn't within that framework to bring it out. Well, let me give you another example. Sinclair Broadcasting controls outlets, owns outlets that reach one quarter of the American public, as well as the major outlets in all of the big in all of the big swing states. They were going to issue a documentary, a news documentary, that was a severe attack on John Kerry before the last elections. This came out in the Los Angeles Times on a Friday, two or three weeks before the elections. The Kerry campaign, the Democratic National Committee, complained to the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Election Commission, nothing happened. But at the same time, roughly, conversations began in the blogosphere about what do we do about this? How do we do about this? In these particular places, people started talking, Within about 36 hours, a couple of sites were set up, one to get signatures, the other to boycott local programming. And what you saw, another way of representing the same story, is roughly like this. This is the stock price of Sinclair over this period. The first report in the Times is over here. The boycott, there's a lot of conversation happening in the first 36 hours of what should we do. Let's boycott them. Let's ticket outside of broadcast. Let's oppose their broadcast licensing renewal. Let's write letters. Then the Democratic establishment vows action on the senators, goes out, and this is about here. And then around these days, people actually say, no. Let's start calling local advertisers. Forget the broadcast manager. Let's call local advertisers. Somebody else says, here's a list. I've put together a list. Watch the 6 o'clock news. Within roughly another 36 hours, people begin to write in and say, I called this. It turns out you should call the advertising manager at the local station, as well as the advertising, not the broadcast managers. People start working. Mass media reports show up around Thursday. By Friday, Lehman Brothers issues a report that says, well, there's a lot of risk here in what Sinclair is doing, so we're downgrading a little bit. This is Monday morning, this is Tuesday. Miraculously here, Tuesday morning, around the middle of the morning, Sinclair says, documentary? We weren't doing this documentary. No, we're just showing little snippets, and we're showing all sorts of other responses. Very interesting story about structuring response to the media. Another version of the same idea of media watching.
Loud and large protests against the attack on Iraq now have swarmed the streets of Boston, calling for an end to military action. And I think Julia Claire followed the demonstrations.
Protesters tried to march onto the Mass Pike.
Contrary to some reports, use of media to monitor and counteract. The model of the watchdog, the press's watchdog, peer production of watchdog. Let's hear a story. So the traditional story is Daniel Ellsberg goes and gives the Pentagon Papers, which are the first time that the American public actually sees the extent of the difficulties in Vietnam and the hiding. And this really starts the Nixon administration's look. So this is the classic height of the press as watchdog. New York Times reports to the public. U.S. Department of Justice brings an injunction, blocks this. The New York Times sends it over to the Washington Post. The injunction comes over. The New York Times pushes back with the United States Supreme Court canceling the injunction. The First Amendment wins. This is the classic story of the success of the traditional media using its muscle, its respectability, its power to be the watchdog. How does this happen in peer production? So Diebold is the company that produces most electronic voting machines. It's the one that produced all of the voting machines in Brazil. you know, the U.S. in 2000 had a bit of an issue with its election and its respectability. So in 2002, they begin to introduce machines, and you would think that the mass media would actually say, well, are these machines any better? Do they, can you punch the cards? As it turns out, nothing in the mass media except for, well, some people were concerned, but we were told by Diebold officials that they're going to tell them, and we were told by the election officials locally who bought these machines that they're perfectly fine. So these are wonderful. One activist, Ben Harris, gets a hold of some source code by some means or other, unclear, puts them on her site, Black Box Voting, as well as on a New Zealand site called scoop.com, and calls for help. Now, here are some critical aspects of the way the network public sphere works. So, here's the materials. You read it. Not we will put New York Times reporters for 3 weeks in a secret hideout and pay there for their pizza delivery and have them work through this. Here are the materials, read them. And moreover, people will try to clamp down on this, so replicate them in all sorts of places. Some of them are password protected, but these nice people here have all sorts of ways of getting around passwords. Some of them may be corrupt. Well, here are some utilities that some other nice people put up there to repair them. And not, here are we, the responsible people, telling you. There's lots of really important stuff buried here. Good hunting. Let us know in the forum here what you find. Completely different conceptions. How does this work? It turns out to work reasonably well. One of these many people who actually end up reviewing in all of these is Avi Rubin from Johns Hopkins and his group. He has the advantage of being a fancy cryptographer at an academically very serious cryptographic area, so that creates media exposure. Diebold responds. Maryland, one of the states that bought Diebold machines, starts saying, well, we need some serious studies, and they end up requiring changes. But that's not all. Ben Harris then becomes an interesting location. So some anonymous whistleblower sends a whole bunch of internal incriminating emails to Wired, and Wired has a story that goes roughly like, can you believe these incompetent fools at Diebold? They lost their emails again. And that's it. Harris puts the emails in back pocket and says, good hunting. Let's see what we find. But this time, Diebold gets wise, brings a Digital Millennium Copyright Act threat and to her ISP and says, these are copyrighted materials. They're ours. And you can't have them. Take them off. So they go off. But some of these users are some students in Swarthmore. And they still have these materials. Well, Diebold says, we know what to do with you. Your ISP is Swarthmore College. We're going to send the same kind of letter to Swarthmore and shut you down. And Swarthmore gets the letter and in fact shuts them down, and that's the end of the story, right? Wrong, as it turns out, because the students have already sent it to other campuses, to other individuals. They've injected it into Freenet, censorship-resistant peer-produced software. They put it into Overnet, both with accessible with eDonkey. So here are illegal, free, and critical communities creating an entire environment that makes it practically impossible to shut down. So you have free software developers developing Freenet, developing free software readers for what is a proprietary created, or at least a commercially created platform for P2P file sharing that has its own interests over there. But we have a new ecology that doesn't require. So what happened is these emails then get, oh my goodness, we have media stories about this, and the emails get read by the California State Commission, and this leads within a couple of months to decertification of a whole chunk of Diebold machines in California, the largest state in the United States. The students also bring a declaratory action to the U.S. District Court saying, this is free speech, you can't stop this, and in fact they win 1 year later and too late to affect the election. So this is inverted to the traditional model of the big media with its money and its power using the Supreme Court to get. Here the law ends up being irrelevant. At least the law that has to do with free speech as opposed to the law that has to do with stuff. So nothing is older in internet commentary than to say that the internet democratizes. And the classic model is the everyone a pamphleteer model. Everyone can be a pamphlet. So we had a first generation of objections largely falling under the idea of the Babel objection. So the first is fragmentation. Nicholas Negroponte talked about the Daily Me as something lovely. Cass Sunstein talked about the Daily Me. There's no public sphere. We're only talking to ourselves. The public sphere disappears. So one of the responses we have is the culture of observed speech, a lot of mutual linking, a lot of see for yourself. The data is here. You read it. Some sense that out there, there will be someone with the competence, like an Avi Rubin, to assess these things. And a lot of aggregation and search capabilities, be it Technorati, be it MoveOn.org, in all sorts of media. And also, power law distribution of links, which we'll talk about in a minute, which is a critique of a second generation, actually solves this problem. In fact, there's a small number of very highly places. Polarization, right? Because everybody's only talking to themselves, they become more polarized. This turns out, first of all, to be complex, and second, to be not accurate descriptive. Complex because the fact that, for example, neo-Nazis can find themselves more easily, can find each other and organize more easily, doesn't mean there's a polarization of the public sphere at large. It means there's better and easier organization for groups one might severely want to constrain. So there's a bigger problem with policing certain things. But it's not polarization of the public sphere. It's only if fragmentation leads to the public sphere, not people not being able to speak in common, that polarization. Empirically, we see recently from last March, there's a piece by Lada Adamic and Nancy Glantz that shows that it's actually about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 of the top of the links in top political blogs are across the political divide. Esther Hargitay and others also find a similar. There's a lot of internal, heavy internal linking between, say, Republican blogs and Democrat blogs in the US, but also no polarization, no clear sense that they become more extreme over time by talking to each other. There's the concern that money will end up controlling attention anyway, and this is something we need to deal with. And there's the question of who will be the watchdog that we've already talked about. We're beginning to see peer production of the watchdog function. The second generation critique is that power law distribution of attention nullifies the everyone a pamphleteer. You can talk, but no one will hear. This solves the problem of fragmentation, by the way, but only at the expense of losing. So what's a power law distribution? A normal distribution looks like this, with very few things having high values of something, very few things having low values of something, and the majority having very little. A power law distribution is a huge number of things has very little of something, a very small number of things has a huge number of something. In this case, it's links going into a site. So links going into a site have this, millions have none or one, and very few have thousands or millions linking to them. Okay, so you see why this was interpreted initially as the reemergence of broadcast. So in 1999, we have a very important paper by Barabashi and Albert. Power law laws characterized degree distributions in many kinds of networks. Their theory was the rich get richer. When I'm looking to link to something, I'll link to something that's already linked to. So once you're there, Adamic and Huberman actually show, well, you know what, that would mean that the old ones would be the most highly linked in a really hugely skewed distribution, and that's not true. So they have a different hypothesis. It's intrinsic growth rates. Could be because it's very interesting. Could be because you're investing a lot of money. But in any event, both of these think that there's only a small number of sites that are very, very visible, and that the difference is huge. No, Boycott SVG in 1 week reaches 300,000 unique users. In that same week, StopSinclair.org has 150,000 signatures. Both of these were set up on a Monday and by Friday have these numbers. That doesn't fit with this model, and yet intuitively it's obvious. People tell to each other, right? We know how this happens. People tell to each other, they care about something, they see it on the web. So we have this distinction between the theory of power laws and the observed links, and also the intuitively appealing fact of the availability. So how do we do this? We can back this out of the graph theory literature. First of all, we see a lot of clustering, which is to say things that are about the same thing link to each other a lot more. It's not that surprising. Again, it's there in the empirical literature. It's there in the mathematical analyses, but the interpretation has been we're seeing the reemergence of broadcast. In fact, what we're seeing is topical clusters cluster together. People point to each other a lot. We have the emergence of a giant strongly connected core, which is about 30-some percent of sites can be connected to and are connected to every other site. Another 25% or so can be reached from everywhere in the net, and another half or so can only reach into or not reach at all. The critical point here, again, is the one of baseline. Barabashi, for example, in Lint, looked at this and says, look, half the places on the net can't be reached from anywhere. I, thinking of the baseline of the mass media, say, half the places on the net can be reached from everywhere? Can you imagine a public sphere where half the statements can be reached after spending 150 years within a mass media public sphere? It's an enormous advance. The other important finding was that at sufficiently small scales, the body becomes moderate instead of having a power law distribution. So we have a paper that shows that universities and companies link to each other. We've got a Chakrabarti paper that shows narrower topical clusters. When they're very narrow and small, you see a moderate body. Even among political blocs, you see it. And just how does this look differently? Instead of looking like this kind of distribution or this kind of distribution, it looks roughly like this. So what do we get here? We get three things. Instead of being tapered off here at a reasonably connected rate, we've got a few sites that are really well connected, even at small sites. But we've got a moderate body. A good number of sites has a decent number of links, instead of almost no sites having a decent and just everybody having either none or a huge number, with very few having a huge number. Why does this matter? Because now, if you look at this, the tail is no longer the broadcaster that everyone looks. The tail is now the transmission antenna of this community. Because now there are dozens of places where you could enter a conversation that's topically linked. Do you have a form of peer review, as it were, of what's interesting? And what captures the interest of this group also captures the interest of these members of the group. But these members are now sufficiently visible that they can be seen outside of the group as well. And they become a way for the group to transmit itself very broadly. So, when you take topical clusters, when you say moderate visibility with many entry points for discussion and mechanisms for essentially peer review, intense interest becomes the core value, and the superstars serve as transmitter towers as opposed to broadcasters that everybody receives, and a huge, strongly connected core with shallow walks so that if you're on one of these transmitters, you can be seen from the majority of the web. You get a very different kind of public sphere. More democratic, after all, is the understated version of it. No, not everyone a pamphleteer, but we're also not intellectual lemmings. A structured web offers more visibility to more people in accreditation and filtration clusters that are relatively local. They moderate the financing constraints on speech. You don't have to speak. They make it relatively incorruptible in the sense that given that speech happens in so many places in so many forms, it's hard to buy them all out. And visibility depends on what's intensely interesting to smaller clusters of interest instead of what's moderately inoffensive to very large numbers of people. So the Baywatch effect gets responded to. So now I want to talk a little bit about a critical culture. Asking your patience, because we did start about 20 minutes late. The first thing is plasticity and malleability. Emerging possibilities for relatively high production value folk culture. Within law, we've had people writing, Niva Elkin-Koren about 10 years ago, about meaning-making processes in a Bakhtin version. Fisher, following Fisk, doing semiotic democracy. Jack Balkin recently wrote about glomming on. So this is roughly what we're talking about, giving both you and I. Thank you.
good. I'm playing a like a chop, like a kid with a dance. It's a West Virginia that booms. I feel it in your brain like a poisonous West was deadly. When I play it, you know it out anything less than the best of the messy. Now that the party is jumping, with a bass kicked in and the biggest on the pumping, bring to the back to your corner, don't break it. Come in and see like a pound of bacon, turn up the skin, drink and mingle. I can feel you when I hear a simple and hot and good one, super tempo. Come on, roll, turn into song, I'm rolling. Here's my heart for a moment, my mind's not down, so my hair can blow. Still ain't gonna stand while I raise the leg high.
Okay, so we have Queen Bowie Under Pressure, Vanilla Ice sampling it, creating Ice Ice Baby. On the way, these are still at the level of professional. Then Under Ice mashes them both, and then Peter Tom Wolverton creates this video, mixing that with a variety of anime. There's a whole culture of music videos being produced in this way, and you see how it transitions within something that is manageable for the cultural industries and the copyright industries into something that is threatening beyond belief, because it changes what it is that people want. They want to do, not to receive. They also want to receive, but they want to do fundamentally. They want to be part of the creation. We also, in addition to plasticity, see transparency. So, for example, the Barbie definition on Wikipedia is a fairly detailed one, including both the work on the critique of Barbie, as well as the claims about the fact that it's the first time that it's not a baby and putting girls in the role of nurturers, but also a professional. And also, we have conversation about the dimension. There's the definition, then there's the point of actually talking about the definition. Rendering transparent. By comparison, Microsoft Encarta's encyclopedia, this is the entry for Barbie, which is vastly more detailed than anything that exists in any of the other online encyclopedias, except for Britannica, which has something that's as good as Wikipedia. So for example, encyclopedia.com, which is the Columbia encyclopedia, has Barbie Klaus. But they don't miss the opportunity, obviously, to advertise them. When you look at Google, which peer produces relevance by actually getting the judgments from around the network through what people link to, then again, very quickly, The second site is Adios Barbie, a body image for every site. You see the critique right there. When you look at Overture, which actually sells placement, you can go for many pages before you hit Adios Barbie when they run out of people to pay for placement. So that's about the critical culture. So we talked about autonomy, about the public sphere in terms of politics, and about the cultural public sphere. And I want to end by talking about justice. And here, this is a more functional rather than intrinsic claim. More of what makes for human welfare and development depends on information, knowledge, and culture. At the simplest level, if we just take the critical components of the Human Development Index, health, life expectancy, being able to live a long and healthy life, education or literacy to be well informed about what is going on and capable of expressing yourself, and material well-being, GDP per capita or growth. Each of these is critically dependent today on information, be it from food security and research in agriculture, to medicines, to research in journals, to outcomes data about what it is that is actually happening in the world and how we understand what good practices are, to education and literacy, books and teaching materials, computation and communications, libraries, academic centers, journals. And we've known for a long time that growth is driven by innovation much more than by anything else. Now we can see that more can be done through non-market and non-intellectual property-based mechanisms by individuals alone, by traditional non-profits with greater reach, and by newly emerging practices of peer production. Essentially, we have a new solution space for these problems. And the question is how we design it. So without going into the details, we can think of any given production system in this area as always having involved some government, some universities, individuals, NGOs, nonprofits, and both IP-based industry and non-IP-based industry. And the question is, how can we weave what is essentially a collaboration here that is outside of the IP system? And so in software, which is one place where it's succeeding, it's very easy to see how this happens. We have funding, procurement, law, we have research and designs in universities, we have the free software development community, as well as the NGOs in this field and the standard setting. And the critical fact here, that software services, which doesn't rely on IP, is twice the size of software publishing. And this is, in the United States alone, this is roughly a $200 billion a year industry, which is completely free of IP. It doesn't need it. It uses it because that's what people do. But the one reason why IBM can be so generous is because it's here. This is a $200 billion a year industry. That's almost three times the size of all of Hollywood and the recording industry put together. Scientific publication, initially we see funding NIH going to promotion and tenure in universities, going to the professional associations and Elsevier and creating this framework. What we've seen with the open access initiative is more of these links being made to the way that working papers and web-based self-publishing is archived, to the creation of Public Library of Science, ARCSIV, the Budapest Open Access Initiative, OYSTER in Michigan. So we're beginning to see a very successful alternative architecture that is now going fighting over professional associations. And the NIH now says, if you want to get money from us, you have within 12 months to put it somewhere here, right? Somewhere either in the market or non-marketplace where it's available for free. So we're beginning to see their success. And the question is, to what extent we can transfer this to other areas? That's a critical research question today. In learning materials and textbooks, we have state big role. We have development of materials. MIT OpenCourseWare is an effort here in universities. One of the reasons why this should work is because millions of teachers around the world, they don't need home computers. They just need a computer one in school somewhere to be able to begin to participate. We have a strong and long-standing nonprofit interest. Here we don't really have much that's clear on the nonprofit side. We have a very strong, certainly in the United States, textbook industry. So this is a battle. But we begin from things like when you do Viking ships on Google, this is the first thing you'll find. It's produced by a fifth grade teacher in Gander, Newfoundland. But it's the first link in terms of materials about Viking ships. One person with an interest. Carnegie Mellon begins to develop a virtual chemistry lab which is available freely everywhere as a teaching material. Textbooks, much harder time, have not yet been so successful. One source, one place where we have seen success is graduate students in University of Cape Town producing a South African version, but this is peer production in ambition, but are relatively managed. But the Free High School Science Text actually has a physics science book textbook out free. Starts getting harder when we talk about agricultural and biological innovation. Very strong government commitment for a long time, both the international agricultural research centers and the international centers. A lot of basic research efforts in American universities today to force the Monsantos and DuPonts to give some play, but not particularly successful. No strong non-IP based industry, but very strong NGO support. Rockefeller's been funding these for a long time. And farmers, right? People whose livelihood develops depends on being able to learn and teach each other as well as scientists. So BIOS is the most interesting effort, very interesting patent database, and an effort to create BioForge on the model of SourceForge for free software to allow people to do development. Health, also very hard, but here we have the critical advantage with generics. Once you actually produce the information, there's an industry ready to actually produce the outputs. So the question is how, with the combination and open bioinformatics, we're already seeing open source really taking over, but that's all done in software. Institute for One World Health, an effort to create a nonprofit research body, public-private partnerships or efforts, individual scientists, students. Will Scott from Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis is working, for example, on creating kits that you could teach undergraduate students chemistry. But instead of just manufacturing things that aren't necessary, you actually try to synthesize targets that are produced from distributed computing as potential targets for tropical diseases. These are the kinds of efforts, very, very early version. So, if we conclude, what are the new politics? Essentially, it is directly mapping the technical and the economic on the questions of freedom and justice. A lot of the discussion, certainly in the United States and at the EU level, has been around efficiency and creativity and innovation. It's about freedom and justice, first of all. We're renegotiating the basic conditions of production in the information economy. It's humanistic and global. It is centered on increasing degrees of freedom of action of individuals for and by themselves, with and for others in new forms of community. And it defies easy left-right distinctions, as it turns out. It mixes the potential set of alliances in interesting and new ways. All of this is carried on as a battle over the institutional ecology of the networked environment. In various laws that touch on the physical means necessary to communicate, be it the carriage facilities, here we see open wireless network, and efforts at municipal broadband as well as the primary source of an open physical network, otherwise relatively tightly controlled. We see battles today here at the level of trying to regulate the personal computer in order to protect intellectual property and copyright, to make this a more reliable machine that will be reliable against its owner and in the interests of those who own the content. At the logical layer, the free software and open source software movements are beginning to develop an open area, an open stack, so that can be free of constraints. And at the level of content, we have these two impulses. One is censorship and the beginning of development of censorship-resistant systems. And one is free sharing, peer production, creative commons, people beginning to produce as a cultural matter for each other as opposed to within the intellectual property system. And throughout these, we have social practices, we have laws, and we have a major battle over whether there will be a core common infrastructure open to all and biased in favor of none, so that those who are beginning to develop the network information economy can continue to live. So we live, I'd say, in a moment of opportunity. Technology has periods of relative openness followed by stabilization. Radio was point-to-point or small scale for about 25 years, and then within a very short period became the broadcast model through a variety of both technological constraints, economic moves, regulatory moves. It's a fairly complex set of interactions, but within a short period it was open and then it closed down. Telephone similarly was open and then became the utility that it was. The stakes of the moment must be understood in terms of political morality. And the window is relatively narrow, presumably about a decade or so, is when we're renegotiating the terms of freedom, justice, and welfare for several decades to come. So I end this as something of a challenge. As economic policy, allowing the incumbents of the industrial information economy to set the terms of productivity and competition tomorrow is a mistake. As a matter of political morality, missing the opportunity not only to improve productivity, but to improve the conditions of autonomy, of democracy, and of social justice is unforgivable. Thank you.
Only to